Just letting all of our whirling thoughts, if we have any, settle into just open awareness of the present moment. And now we'll do the first four prayers to be recited at teachings to set our motivation and empower our practice and earn some merit. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And now prayers for the teacher for the four dharmas of Gampopa. Dadan sem shantam chelo chasudro or zinji lapti sol chalam dudro or zinji lapti solam chulpa so or zinji lapti sol chulpa yeshe suchar or zinji lapti sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dang lu dang nu jin ke chubum darami ke nam dang drava kunji draki jitam har tam chi ke du dagi chitento. In the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So does anybody have any questions before we start? We're just going to go straight to the text today. And somebody can let me know the page number. Just waiting for Yeah, so we're actually going to backtrack a tiny bit to the last section of chapter 2 under the heading, The Process of Interdependent Origination. We're just going to read a little bit of that. I'm not going to take extra time to review or recap, even though it's been a little while since we met, because I think everybody has basic familiarity with the 12 links at this point, and because it will be reviewed through the text itself. All of the points will be addressed. Anybody have any questions before we do that? Yes, Joanne, I'm unmuting you.
It's not quite a question. I have it on Kindle. Mm-hmm. I also have printed it out, and according to my printout, it's on page 18.
Okay, great. And if you're on a Kindle, it's location 313. Yes, Marilyn, I'm going to unmute you. Yep.
Can you
Okay, we can't, I'm sorry, we can't hear you. Can you, I'm sorry, come back, come close to the computer.
The pages from the printout, the PDF, are not the same as the book pages. The pages in the actual book are page 22, and the process of dependent origination is page 19, I think, of the printout.
Okay, so page 18 of the, I'm sorry. Yeah, page 22 of the book, is that what you're saying? And page 19 of the printout. The PDF file that I sent. Okay. So the process of interdependent origination, and it's probably helpful, although it's completely optional if you have the, you know, the the diagram of the wheel, and you can refer to that as we go through. So let me make sure I have my notes handy. Having to rearrange here a little bit. Okay. Through studying the 12 links of interdependent origination, we see that samsara, which is our confused state of existence which leads to our suffering and harming others, we see that samsara evolves from the root of ignorance, that's link one, and through the process of the 12 stages or links. Because of ignorance, we make karmic creations, also known here as mental formations. Sometimes we call them karmic impulses. So that's the second link. And that comes directly from ignorance. Because of the karmic impulses, we have a conditioned stream of consciousness, that's link three. We're born in a certain way, by which he's referring to link four, name and form. That's like our sort of embodiment in this lifetime with all of the five skandhas. Once we are born, we have sense faculties, that's link five, that make contact with the world in link six. Because we have feelings, link seven, which boils down to things, whenever we encounter an experience, we experience it as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that can refer, that doesn't refer to the strength of the reaction, but just to the general character of it. Like pleasant could be extremely pleasant, or it could just be kind of nice, and so forth. So consequently, because we have sense faculties, We make contact with the world through those sense faculties in link six, develop feelings. And because we have feelings and the interaction of the skandhas, which are predispositions, we become involved with certain things. And his translator here is using the word involved to refer to the next three links, 8, 9, and 10. Craving, first we want it or we don't want it. Then in grasping, we go after it. We figure out how we're going to get it or how we're going to avoid it. And in link 10, we actually either get it or we get rid of it. It's the action. So that's our involvement with things. And that's where we get into trouble. So through the 12 links, we see how samsara develops from the first step of ignorance onwards and round and round and round, right? Each link or step forms the basis for the next. Ignorance, the first link, not only forms the foundation of the 12 links, but once the cycle begins, once you have ignorance, it is almost inevitable that the next link will take place, and so on, step by step. And we've figured out that there's a few links, notably 8, 9, and 10, where we could stop the process or mitigate the process, but mostly it's just automatic. So we can see that in order to get rid of the 12th link of aging and death, like that's sort of the culmination of the suffering that is brought about beginning with ignorance and unfolding through all the links. In order to get rid of the 12th link of aging and death and all the problems of life, we need to get rid in the 11th link of worldly rebirth. We need to undo the cycle. And as we've seen, we can't directly intervene in each link, but there are certain links that we can intervene in. So we're gonna skip at this point. to I think we're just going to skip to where we left off, right, which is a couple of paragraphs ahead. The process of dependent origination is going on all the time. Has everybody got that? The process of dependent origination is going on all the time. It is an unbroken continuum of interaction of many elements. Because it is ongoing, we are the way we are due to the past. Because of the way we are now, we are shaping the future. And I don't know if anybody else printed it out, but Lama Jinzong sent us a lovely chart based on our discussion last time that shows exactly which links are involved. Links 1 and 2 are from the past, and their result is links 3 through 7, which is how we are now. Links 3 through 7, how we are now, bring about our present experience, which plays out in links 8 through 10. That's the result of how we are now, is how we act, what we want, how we go about getting it, and what we do to get it. And then links 8 through 10 determine the future. That's what propels us into not only links 11 and 12, which are all the suffering of this life from birth through death, but also back into ignorance again to start the whole process all over again. Does anybody have any questions about that, like the basic process? Okay, we'll continue. Because it is an ongoing process, it is compared to a wheel, the famous analogy for samsara. And this is the wheel, the 12 links. The 12 links are the wheel. The famous analogy for samsara. A wheel that spins round and round and round from lifetime to lifetime and also from one experience to the next again and again. So this entire process is called interdependent origination, which means that things originate from each other and depend upon each other. The process is called Tenchen Drelwa in Tibetan, or we usually hear referred to as Tendral, the shorter form of that. Ten means one thing is a basis for another, and Drelwa means things are connected and related. So it just sort of sums up, like this is the word for interdependence. In other words, there is a process of causality. Whenever something happens, it does so because of certain circumstances and conditions. If there is a result, there was a cause, and wherever there is a cause, there will be a result. Causes do not become nothing. If there are causes, results must follow. If there is a result, it must be because of a particular cause. In the explanation of the 12 links, we saw that the middle set of links concern what is happening in this life because of conditions coming from past lives. The middle links, and here he's referring to 8, 9, and 10, the middle links are the foundation from which we are creating the nature of the lives to come. So there's like a nice quote. I sent it out as an email, but I'm going to read it from Ringu Tulku, Path to Buddhahood, and Lama Jinzong read this last week in our class on Gampopa, but it speaks exactly to this. It's on page 42 of Path to Buddhahood. He says, of course we can't change what we are now because we already are what we are. There is nothing we can do about it because it is the result of our past, but we can partially control what we will be in the future. If the past made our present, then our present can in turn make our future. What we can be in the next moment, the next year, or the next life is in our hands right now. And again, we want to focus on 8, 9, and 10, craving to have something or to get rid of something, like that feeling, like from pleasant or unpleasant, we want to either prolong the experience or we want to stop the experience. And that's where we start getting into trouble. If we could just live with the fact that something is pleasant or unpleasant, and not either go after it or try to get rid of it, we'd be good. We're good all the way through link 7. But it's that feeling of desire or aversion that gets us into trouble, that strong craving one way or the other. And then, so we could intervene there if we can recognize that that's happening. If not, we might catch ourselves in link 9, which is where we is called grasping. That's where we start planning. Like we actually make the plan or start to move towards, you know, getting what we want or getting rid of what we don't want. And then if we don't stop ourselves there, maybe we could catch ourselves before we actually speak or physically act, which is where the karma is actually created. So these are the links from which we are creating the nature of the lives to come, as Chöngö Rinpoche says. So now we are going to skip most of chapter 3. That's, you can read that on your own. It's very technical, and it's, I don't feel like we really need to get into that to have a basic practical understanding of the 12 links. So we're going to skip to the view, which is sort of in the middle of chapter 3. That's the heading. And if anybody has a, Lama Jinzang, do you have a page number for us?
Well, the particular, oh, am I, can you
hear me? I've unmuted you, yeah.
For the copy that I have, it seems to be a little different. It's a PDF, but mine is in the middle of page 22.
Okay.
It might be different for others, but it's around 22 then that I have.
Okay, thank you. And Marilyn, do you have other page numbers for us?
24 for the book.
Okay. Okay, great. I'm sure, like, it's in that range, so I'm sure everybody can find it if you haven't already. All right, the view. In answering the question why one experiences various kinds of happiness and suffering, some believe that there is a powerful being, a God, who creates all of this, who determines who will be happy and who will suffer. The Buddhist view is not like that. Rather, the Buddhist view is that if the causes of suffering have been created, then there will be suffering. It's like a domino effect. You push over that first domino and all the other dominoes are going to fall. You can't really stop that because it happens so inexorably. It is not that some external being has decided to make us miserable for some reason. And here I want to just put in a word for, you know, in defense of the theistic religions, that generally it's not considered to be random. You know, that's getting more into other areas. It's like, it's that a being has decided, it's a being has decided the same thing that karma decides, which is you've done something bad and you need to be punished for it, or you've done something good and you need to be rewarded for it. So we're just taking the being out of the equation. The Buddhist view is that the causes have come together completely and manifested their result, that things happen because a certain cause creates the potential for the result, and then conditions, like particular conditions, you know, you've set up, you know, you've been terrible in some previous lifetime, you've done something to harm someone, and the karmic result is going to be illness, and you encounter the flu germ, you know, that's the condition. So the cause is that you engaged in some harmful deed, and that the result is that you get the flu when the flu germ appears. So likewise, when we experience happiness, it is because the various factors that give rise to happiness have come together, the cause and the conditions for us to experience happiness. It's not because an external being looked at our life and decided that it would be appropriate for us to be happy. So the value of the Buddhist view is that it places our destiny in our own hands. If we want to be happy in the future, then we need to gather the causes to produce the happiness we want. If we do not want to suffer, then we need to eliminate anything that might be a cause of suffering. That is the basic view of karma. That's what it says in The Torch of Certainty. For those of you who have done the first level of the Dharma path, that the workings of karma, like how these causes and conditions play out, the workings of karma are really complex and can't be understood until you reach a certain level of realization. But in the meantime, we can work with this basic understanding that if we do things that are positive and helpful, we will have happiness. If we do things that are harmful, then we will reap suffering in the future. That is the basic law of karma. In a greater perspective, says Trungpa Rinpoche, this also means that our enlightenment is in our own hands. We can free ourselves from this whole cycle. We have that power. If we want to achieve total enlightenment, total awakening, then we must do everything that will lead to enlightenment, which consists of, you know, our study, contemplation, and meditation. If we do these things, then we will indeed reach total enlightenment. So that's like the basic underpinning of the whole, like how we relate to what the usefulness is of understanding the 12 links. Anybody have any questions or comments so far? Okay, so we're going to skip now to chapter 4. That should be easy to find. It's a bit ahead. And there's a lot of interesting material in between, but I don't feel like I'm really qualified to lead anyone through it because I haven't studied it in these terms with my own teachers. So chapter 4, the relevance of interdependence for the Buddhist teachings. I'm just looking at my notes to see if there's anything I need to. Okay. The teachings on interdependent origination are studied by Buddhists in all three vehicles. So that's interesting to know. This is at every level of Buddhism, just like basic sitting meditation, like following the breath and so forth, is included in all Buddhist paths. So are the teachings on interdependent origination. We may say that there are three vehicles, the Shravaka, the Pratyeka Buddha, and the Bodhisattva vehicles. The Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas seek individual liberation. They're both, like, this is a slightly different way of defining vehicles, but we don't need to worry about that. It's just talking about different paths, the path of the hearers, the path of the self-made Buddhas, and the path of the bodhisattvas, the Mahayana practitioners who are working on behalf of all beings. So the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas are more focused on their own liberation, on individual liberation from samsara. The bodhisattvas seek to liberate all beings. The teachings of interdependent origination are particularly studied by the solitary realizers, the self-made Buddhas, Sanskrit Pratyeka Buddhas. The Pratyeka Buddhas are practitioners who develop tremendous insight and wisdom, and from these, they develop a powerful and natural revulsion for samsara. Like, they see the cycle, and they really, really want to get out of it. They really understand that there's no happiness anywhere in it, and they really want to get out of it. They're very highly motivated. Although they seek out and receive teachings from great masters, the Pratyeka Buddhas prefer to develop and gain wisdom themselves. They do this in particular by studying the process of interdependent origination. So this is one of the ways that you cultivate wisdom, which is one of the two qualities that we need for full awakening, wisdom and compassion. And it's said that if you fully develop wisdom, then compassion is part of that. So the Pratyeka Buddhas, the self-made Buddhas, develop wisdom by studying the process of interdependent origination. And we're going to skip the rest, which is just more details about how that plays out for them. We're going to go to the next full paragraph, which starts the understanding of the process of interdependent origination. So the understanding of the process of interdependent origination, however, is very important for all Buddhists, all three levels, Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas. An understanding of interdependent origination helps us understand how things function on the conventional truth level and also how things function on the ultimate level. So this is one of the things we've talked about at the beginning of most of our classes, like, why do we study the 12 links? What's the point of it? And the point of it is that all of the Buddhist teachings are divided into, I mean, the main point of the Buddhist teachings is that we transcend our confusion. We dispel our confusion and we see things the way they really are. And that is the ultimate level. What he's talking here, what he calls here the ultimate truth level or the ultimate level. That's what we want to gain by our study, contemplation, and meditation. But in order to understand the ultimate level, we need to understand how things function on the conventional truth level, meaning how do we create this confusion in the first place that keeps us spinning around and keeps us suffering and keeps us causing harm. So studying the 12 links of interdependent origination helps both by helping us understand conventional reality, like how we got into this pickle and how we maintain it. That will eventually help us dispel that confusion so that we can understand the ultimate level of how things are. By understanding interdependence, back to Trungpa Rinpoche, we begin to understand the power of actions done in our previous lives. When we analyze the links, some show what happened in the past. Others show what influences the present, and still others deal with how the present sets the stage for the future. So that is where the Lama Jinzong's chart comes in handy. Like links 1 and 2 are about the past. All the middle links up to there are how the present is structured. And then when by the time we get to 8, 9, and 10, that's what's going to determine the future and set the whole thing in motion again. In particular, what we appreciate through an understanding of interdependence is that causes produce results, especially that good or bad actions we performed in past lives are the reasons for the happiness and suffering that we experience presently. So here he's restating what he told us in the view. You do good things, you get happiness. You do bad things, you get suffering. We also, and that a lot of those causes are in the past. Like we don't have control. It's not like what we're doing now. It's what we've already done that makes that determination of our present experience. So therefore, he says, we also begin to realize that what we are doing now is setting the stage for our future experience. And this is why it's so important to understand the 12 links and how we can alter the habitual patterns that we've developed from the past and that are playing out in the present, how we can begin to alter those to begin to free ourselves so that we don't have to keep going through the same thing moment after moment, experience after experience, relationship after relationship, job after job, and life after life. So back to Trungpa Rinpoche, this drives home the message that we need to do only those things that create happiness and get rid of those things that cause suffering and difficulties. And that is actually what the word Buddha means. If we accomplish both of those things, then we are Buddha. That is how you get to be Buddha. The first syllable of Buddha's song is the second thing. That's having purified all of the things that cause suffering. And then the J part is the expansion or the creation of all the things that create happiness, all of the things that create happiness and liberation. We've gotten rid of all of the bad stuff that we had created in the past, and we have brought to fruition all of the good things, all of the positivity, all of our practice has come to fruition. So that's all we have to do. Get rid of the things that cause suffering and create the things, only engage only in actions that lead to happiness and liberation. Because of the nature of interdependence, how one thing produces another, we realize that we need to give up our obscuring emotions of anger, desire, and so on. And I want to say here that I really like this translation, obscuring emotions. You know, we call them different things. There's many different translations for what in Tibetan is called nyumungs. We've called them negative emotions. We call them destructive emotions. We call them emotional afflictions or mental afflictions. And they all sound like, I think to me, none of them quite hits the nail on the head, but this does. They're the emotions that obscure our true nature. They're the filters, as we've talked about before, the filters through which we see things that causes our confusion. Anger, desire, pride, jealousy, greed, those things are filters that keep us from seeing the way things really are. So once we understand interdependence, we realize that we need to give up these obscuring emotions of anger, desire, and so on. And which link are those in? They're in one link, like they start in one link, and that is link 8. That's craving, which can be positive or negative. So that's what we need to give up ultimately, because they lie near the root of all suffering, which takes place as a result of interdependence. Now, that's an interesting thing that he said, because they lie near the root of all suffering. they actually, all of the obscuring emotions, the emotional afflictions, come from the root of ignorance or ego clinging, ego orientation, seeing things, seeing ourselves as separate and seeing everything from the point of view of what we want or what we don't want. So that's the actual root, but they lead directly into what he's calling the obscuring emotions here. They lead directly, it's ego clinging, ego orientation, like me first, that leads into wanting this. Because I'm important, I must have this. Because, you know, it's important for me not to suffer, not to be unhappy, I must not have that bad experience. I must avoid that. So where does it leave us if we don't engage in those, if those are not arising? We're back at link seven, just feelings. Like, things could feel pleasant or unpleasant, and that would not have to, you know, expand or blossom into craving, anger, aversion, jealousy, pride, and so forth. So is everybody with me so far? I haven't covered anything really new. You know, it's all different ways of saying the same things, so that they will imprint upon us and we can make use of them. Anybody have any questions or comments? All right, so we'll go on. Understanding that all things are manifest, that manifest to our mind. Okay, let's think about what that means. All things that manifest to our mind means all of our experience. Every single thing that happens to us, every single thing that we think, every single thing that we feel. Understanding that all things that manifest to our mind are interdependent means that we can begin to understand the ultimate truth. And he's going to now explain, like, the difference between conventional or relative and ultimate truth. The difference between seeing things in a confused way and seeing things the way they really are. So he says, this happens because by studying the way things appear through the play of interdependence, we begin to realize that nothing is as solid, as real, or as concrete as it seems to be. It's not a freestanding, inevitable thing. It comes about through causes and conditions. In fact, things manifest, when we understand this, things manifest as what they really are, which is empty. And he's going to explain what that means really nicely, I think, really helpfully. The Tibetan word for conventional reality is kunzop, meaning literally totally artificial or fake. Like, we have this nice term for it, conventional reality, like just the way we see things in sort of an ordinary way. But in the Tibetan, it actually means it's completely fake. And actually, Tony Duff, who created the Illuminator Dictionary online, which is really helpful if you want to learn or translate Tibetan, he translates it not as conventional reality, but as fictional reality, which I think is really good. Really fake. Everything is a fabrication, and its very nature depends upon the components of which it is fabricated. All of those interdependent causes and conditions that come together to make it appear a certain way. No phenomenon can exist on its own. That's one of those things you could get tattooed on your arm. That's like a really important, you know, underpinning of the entire Buddhist view. And one of the, you know, if we could remember that, we could free ourselves if we could just keep that in mind. No phenomenon can exist on its own. All things depend upon other things for the nature they take on at a particular time. By understanding interdependence, we can also come to understand that all things are empty, in that they are devoid of any lasting reality. So things being devoid of any lasting, permanent, independent reality is what emptiness means. He says we can see that emptiness, shunyata in Sanskrit, does not mean a dead emptiness such as one finds in empty space. It means that, and I think this is a really lovely definition of emptiness. It's probably long for a tattoo, so maybe you could put it on like an index card. It means that on a conventional level, this fictional reality level, this fake reality level, on a conventional level, things only exist in interdependence. And on an ultimate level, they are devoid of any existence whatsoever. The Buddha gave the profound teachings on the perfection of wisdom, prajnaparamita or pranayaparamita in Sanskrit, which we know primarily through the Heart Sutra, the short, you know, the short recitation that, for example, is done every day at the monastery. The Buddha gave the profound teachings on the perfection of wisdom, but most of his followers did not understand these teachings at the time. These are the teachings on emptiness. About 500 years later, these teachings were thoroughly understood by the great master Nagarjuna. He understood the Pranayaparamita remarkably clearly, not just from the level of intellectual understanding, but also from actual experience. Nagarjuna was able to present these teachings thoroughly and completely through logical arguments. In particular, he presented the Buddha's teaching on emptiness through what are called the five areas of wisdom, in one of which interdependence is especially stressed. So this is where we get the teachings on interdependence as we have them now, as we know them now, through Nagarjuna, which he created through his intellectual understanding and his direct experience. Nagarjuna shows that all phenomena we experience, each and every phenomenon, again, he's saying the same thing in different words, each and every phenomenon only exists through dependence upon other things, and no phenomenon has an essential existence of its own. In practical terms, like for me, when I talk about emptiness to people who have not encountered emptiness before, my working definition is that no situation is limited to being the way that I see it in this moment, because things change from moment to moment and things change from perspective to perspective. Like three people in a room having the same experience will all have a different experience, and they will remember it quite differently, like 10 years in the future, as we know from many arguments we've had with our friends and family about what actually happened. And then you get into other beings. You know, we were talking recently, and I guess it wasn't this class, about like how things look to the ants on my kitchen counter. You know, I mean, I'm experiencing a completely different reality from, say, the pet dog or the pet cat, the pet goldfish. We're all in the same room and the same thing is happening. We all have a completely different experience. And this, to me, is the essence of emptiness in a practical application. If you could just remember when you're about to engage in an argument with somebody, a political argument, an argument about something that happened in the past, an argument about something you're about to do, some plan you're making, if you could just remember that nothing, no situation is limited to being the way that I am experiencing it. Everybody's seeing a different thing. It would really help. And it means that your way of seeing it is not the ultimate truth. It's not ultimate reality. It's dependent on causes and conditions. And the person next to you has different causes and conditions. Obviously, they overlap in some way because you're sharing an experience, but you may be experiencing it completely differently. So when you think you're absolutely right and the other person is absolutely wrong, it really helps to bring this to mind. Like, you could allow a little space that they may be seeing something that you're not seeing. And it might be valid or not valid, but most likely, you know, it's all very fuzzy and there's nobody's experiencing it exactly the way it is, because we're all seeing it through our filters of ego orientation, you know, just being stuck in yourself as a separate person, and through the filters of whatever emotionality you may be bringing to the situation, either, you know, obvious or very, very subtle. So to read that bit again, Nagarjuna shows that all phenomena we experience, each and every phenomenon only exist through dependence upon other things, and no phenomenon has an essential existence of its own. Through demonstrating that things merely exist relatively, or fictionally, as Tony Duff would say, he showed that they are devoid of an ultimate nature. This is one of the five main ways in which Nagarjuna presented emptiness, in reliance on an understanding of interdependent origination. Thus, the understanding of interdependent origination helps one understand not only conventional reality, but also ultimate reality. And I just want to say that it, like, not every single thing that Trungpa Rinpoche is expressing here, we may feel like some of it goes a little bit over our head. I quite often feel that way. That's okay. We don't need to worry about that. If we get the main points, everything's interdependent, No situation is limited to being the way that I see it, and so forth. That our fate is in our own hands, that we get into trouble through the emotional, you know, the obscuring emotions. And if we could just pull back on those a little bit by remembering emptiness, that I may not be seeing the whole picture here. Those are the things that we can really use. Or as like Pema Chodron, when she teaches, she always says, this is the news you can use. So anybody have any questions or comments? We have about 15 minutes left. And John, I'm unmuting you. I think you can unmute yourself. Okay.
Yeah, this whole thing about perspective and what you see may not be what others see. Does this apply to what is considered universally as being good as opposed to bad?
Can you give me an example?
Right doing, helping people is good, hurting people is bad. Now that seems to go beyond one person's perspective.
Yeah. Well, that's a really excellent question. I can only fall back on the Buddhist teachings here, that he was fully awakened and he said that if we do negative things, we will suffer. And if we do positive things, we will have happiness. And if we engage in practice, we will liberate ourselves. So there do seem to be some things that are universally true. And in fact, and I'm not an expert on this, so I'm just going to like touch upon it. But there are two, as I understand it, there are two categories of relative reality or conventional reality. And one is like, you can't really call it ultimately true, but one is like a clear view of what's happening. Like it is true. And I think that that falls into that category. And then the other is like when we're misunderstanding, like some of it's just like the innate relativity of things. And some of it is you're getting it wrong. So I think that like the Buddhist teachings on karma, for example, are within, like they are addressing relative reality, but they are giving us things that he says are always true in relative reality. Does that help? Does that help?
Yeah, pretty much. Yes, it adds a different, another perspective. Thanks.
Well, Jensen, I don't want to put you on the spot, but sometimes you express things in a different way than I do that can be very helpful. Do you have anything to add to that?
Could you just repeat again what your actual question was? Because I do have a thought about it, but I realize that maybe I missed what his question was. Could you repeat your question, Mark?
It's John.
John, no, sorry. But,
that's okay. That's okay.
But from my perspective, you're Mark, so there you go.
That's what I was just going to say. Anyway, so the question is, if everyone's seeing things from their own perspective, relatively, and that's why there's different variations of people seeing something. Is there a universal truth, like good or bad, what's good or bad, that transcends that?
So I would say no, because if you look at cultures that thinking they're doing good, they sacrifice animals. They kill things in order to, you know, appease gods and this and that. From their point of view, what they're doing is good. So I don't think ultimately there is a notion of an all good that everyone abides by, just like, you know, this notion that people kill other people because they have this notion that they're going to, you know, heaven and whatever the story is with the, you know, the radical Islamic concepts, you know, if you do this, you're going to meet, you know, some paradise. So I don't think that there is such a thing. I mean, also, I remember Ari Goldfield having said that, you know, he was teaching on a text, I don't remember, many years ago, but that really all we ever have is our own point of view, that, and our biggest problem is that all of us think that we're right. Well, we have our own opinions, but we never think our opinions are the wrong opinions. We always think from our side that our opinion is the right opinion. And then more than that, we're always thinking that our opinion is not only the right opinion, but it's universal truth. And that's where we completely get in trouble. And it's like everyone's convinced that what they're thinking is the right, is the universal right. And that's why everyone's struggling and learning to really recognize that ultimately all we, each and every one of us has, is just our opinion. It's just our opinion. So that's how I would think of that.
Okay, Chet has something to add.
Sure. I think, I mean, looking at it from as a psychologist, in theory right now, we talk about constructionist psychology, where everything is really construction. And some of those constructions are personal and some are social. So, you know, it reminds me so much of this idea about how things are independent in their origination. If you take something like gender, you know, no more than, how many years ago we conceived of gender as being, it was male and it was female. And now our social construction of gender is so much broader. It's really evolving as we think about it. It doesn't change the fact that at one time it was true that it was male and female, and there were all these other variations. Just our understanding has changed so much, and our construction has changed. And so when you talked about, you know, people being in a different room and witnessing the same experience, because everybody constructs that experience entirely differently. It's amazing to me how much Buddhism and psychology can overlap. I know the Dalai Lama has talked about that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Chet. Thank you very much from your professional point of view. And here comes Fanny.
John, thanks for bringing that question up. Again, it gets confusing, like what your personal lens is versus what is universally a positive, loving, you know, being, looking at other people's point of view, if you can, knowing there's a glimpse of another perspective, that what's rising in you is conditioned, you know, even at and it seems to me, again, to me, that if the trap I get into is self-absorption and obscuring emotions, and not being able to see another person's perspective, but knowing that there is one, even though I can't taste it at the time. So isn't that a universal positive thing, to really look at others broader first and recognize that we're all in this together, even though at a time, you know, having that glimpse that I can't quite taste it, but that's really that seems to me a universal truth in every culture, in everything, if we can be a little more expansive. That's how it rings to me. So when Lama Jinzong is speaking of, like, yeah, other people think goodness is sacrifice for their Lord or their God, they do, there does seem some fundamental truths, as John was saying, so, you know, that surpass our own ego clinging. Wow.
Okay, thank you. John, I want to come back to you for a second. How are we doing with your question as a team? Because I feel like we've approached it from two different angles, and I'm not sure which of them more addresses what you were actually asking.
He's muted.
He's actually not muted, but we can't hear him for some reason. John, we're not able to hear you. Yeah, something has gone wrong. Well, I'll just let our minds come to rest for a second. Anybody else have any other comments as we wait to see if we can get John back online? Okay, Lama Jinzong. Oh, sorry. I think I just muted you because you were on mute. Okay.
Okay. So I think that we're into a little bit of semantics, just to thinking in terms of what Fanny just said, because this notion of universal, I mean, what does that actually mean, universal? It's implying that every single person, everything, you know, it's like everyone agrees on something. I mean, what does it even mean to say universal? So that's why I have a question there, because we're talking about is still from our perspective. So this idea, do you mean by universal that I mean, for something to be like this idea in Buddhism, for something to be actually true, it can't just be, as Chet was saying before, he said, well, that about genders, a certain thing was true before. From the Buddhist perspective, if something is just temporarily in a certain way, you can't actually use the term true, because true implies that it's always unchanging permanently. That's the only thing that you can say is true. I mean, that's what the concept of truth refers to. It's not a temporary, like at one time it was true and then it changed. So I guess I'm just questioning, like, for all of us, I think universal is a difficult term, because from my understanding as a definition, it would mean that everyone has exactly the same whatever. And it seems to me from these teachings and from the idea of conditioning that none of us have any idea what anyone else is thinking ever. You know, we might say this is vanilla, but your concept of vanilla, who knows what it is compared to mine. So I'm not even sure the term, you know what I'm saying? So that's just what I'm thinking about.
Right. Yeah, well, when I heard John's question, I heard a little differently. And so the way that I answered it was in terms of, like, there do seem to be, like, the Buddha's teachings seem to encompass some things that are universally true on the relative level, like that negative actions lead to suffering and positive actions lead to happiness. And so I think that, I'm not sure which thing John was asking. But to me,
you just heard him.
Yeah, I would just like to.
Oh yeah, but I'm sorry.
Finish the sentence, and then maybe John can come back on if we got him again. So I was hearing that there are some things that are universally true, that you could say that there are some things that are universally true on a relative level. And I think that's what Fanny was also addressing. Like, would anybody say that love and compassion are bad? Like, would anybody systematically say that? I mean, some grumpy person might say that, but is there anyone that teaches that? Like, that love is a bad value and compassion is a bad value.
Yeah,
so
I understand.
And it reminds me of what, he may have been asking the other thing. So it was very interesting that you heard that and you answered it from that direction. And I think Chet was coming in from that direction as well. So it's reminding me, though, of what Ringu Tulku says in chapter one of basically Ornament of Precious Liberation, the Buddha Nature chapter, that we can see that every human, at least, has some degree of wisdom and compassion. And that's how we know that they have Buddha Nature. So I think, like, for me, that's an answer. But also very interesting that you picked up that, yes, some cultures and some religions hold values that we might consider negative, and vice versa. So John, do we have you back yet?
I do. You?
Yes.
Okay.
Speak,
all right,
John.
Sorry about that. So I was actually thinking the perspective of karma, because that's kind of going to show you right or wrong, you know, right and wrong behavior. And because we say that's going to affect our future. So is that a universal truth? I think that's more where I was coming from.
I would consider it a universal truth, but I think, as Lama Jinzong might point out, not everybody would consider that a universal truth. So if you're asking if it is a universal truth, I think so, because I rely on the Buddhist teachings. You know, I think he knew. And it also, my experience seems to confirm it. But whether it's universally accepted, you know, that's a whole different question. I'm going to unmute Marilyn KDC now, because somebody has a question there or a comment.
I just was thinking, all beings want happiness, no beings want suffering.
Yeah.
There is a universal truth. I think that might be it.
Yeah. And that's what the Dalai Lama always says. When he is going to explain basic Buddhism, he says, all beings share that, exactly that. Every being wants to be happy. Every being wants not to suffer. So thank you so much, John, for your question, because I think it gave rise to a really good discussion. And now, sadly, we are out of time. Joanne, we do have a couple of minutes left. I was going to ask if anybody had anything else to say. So Joanne, go ahead.
I correspond with Christopher. He texts me passages, one of which stands out in my mind, about the Karmapa, or His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa, that each morning he reads scripture from every world religion and as you had pointed out, as Marilyn has, that happiness is what brings them together. So I think that if we can take that perspective always, I think that it would be a good life skill, a skillful means.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Joanne. Anybody else have anything they'd like to say before the clock runs out? Yes, Fanny.
Just to thank everybody for their prayers for the people that I have asked for. And yeah. If they could add, my friend's mom just passed this morning, and her name is Susan.
The friend's name or the mom's name?
The mom's name. Passed this morning at 3:47 a.m. And the friend's name is Sandy. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sandy's mom, Susan.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we'll put her on the Richmond prayer list.
Thank you.
Today is Sunday. Okay. Okay, anybody else? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. So we will wrap up next time then. This is as far as I thought we would get today. But next time we'll pick up with interdependence in the sutras. That's the next section. He's just going to give an explanation. It's not going to be new to anybody, but it's always helpful to hear it, of like what sort of it means that things are in, like how we can see, how we can understand intellectually interdependence, how nothing exists independently. So he's going to explain that from a sutra point of view, and then he's going to explain how interdependence works in Mahamudra, which is much shorter and quicker, because Mahamudra is always about, you know, it's not about intellectual reasoning, but it's about direct experience. And then we get to chapter 5, the last chapter, the 12 links applied to one's action, which is where Trungpa Rinpoche explains how these links work in terms of a particular action, and he takes killing as the subject. So I would like for everybody who plans to join us next week, if you could read chapter 5 in advance and see what you think. And I've also like thought about how it might apply to my favorite example of eating ice cream. So if you want to think about how it might play out in terms of any particular action, I think it's a really good exercise. Mine came out a little different from Trungpa Rinpoche's, because his is actually more from the point of view of all of the 12 links existing at the same time. And so I worked out ice cream in terms of one thing leading to another, like cause, result, cause, result, cause, result. So if you got anything that you want to go through that exercise with, you can use chapter 5 and the 12 links as you understand them as your model. And we'll all convene next week to discuss that. And I actually, if causes and conditions are favorable, I will be at KDC next Sunday. Right, Marilyn? Yes. So that's the plan. If we get a blizzard, I won't be going. there any number of things could happen, but hopefully I'll be there next Sunday. And we'll also be there with Zoom, thanks to John. He's worked out how we can probably do that effectively. We will do our prayers then. And I'll send out a reminder towards the end of the week that we'll be meeting and what we'll be going over. So we're going to do the dedication prayer. I'm just making sure everybody's muted. Okay. So let's take a moment again to bring our minds to rest from all of this thought and discussion, so that we can focus our attention on, like within vast open awareness, we can focus a portion of our attention on dedicating any benefit from this study and contemplation to the enlightenment of ourselves and all sentient beings. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanates. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. All right, everybody's unmuted. Thank you, Trungpa Rinpoche and Trungpa Rinpoche's translator for making the teachings available to us. And I'll see you next week.
Bye.
How is his health?
Bye, Anne.
I haven't heard anymore. I assume he's recovering, continuing to recover. He just had a spinal compression from a fall a while back. But he was doing well then, and some weeks have passed, so hopefully he's pretty well recovered by now. Okay, bye, everybody. I'll exercise the superpower.
Bye. Good to see everyone.